want to start with, as we typically do, by acknowledging that when we gather in this part of the world, we gather on Treaty One territory. And I've been, part of what I did over our vacation time, more on that in a moment, but part of what I did over our vacation time was start working my way through Thomas King's excellent book, The Inconvenient Indian. And I've been reminded of the sequence of treaties in the process of reading that book and where the numbered treaties come from. And so the idea that we meet on the land signified in Treaty One feels like it's an expanding idea for me right now. The other thing that really hit me about that this past week, the last section of our vacation, we were in Riding Mountain for a few days. And one of the things we did there was made the trek out to the sort of the more northwest part of the park, Audie Lake area, for those of you familiar where the bison enclosure is and where Audie Lake is. And we went out there to do some paddling and see if we could see a bison or two, both of which we accomplished. But at Audie Lake at the moment, there is part of the campground is full of First Nations folks who are, according to the Parks Canada signage, and I believe the phrase was unauthorized occupation, which someone had crossed out on the sign that I was looking at and written in pen, sort of, you know, Indian land. And I thought, yeah, you know what, this is an enormously complex intersection. And when we say we're grateful to gather on Treaty One territory, it's a way of just dipping our toe in the complexity, you know. And we need to do that, and we need to do it and redo it and redo it and redo it and keep it in mind, keep it in view. So we're grateful to gather, and we're grateful to gather on Treaty One land. And when I look in the background of the space that I'm in, you know, for which I would use a phrase like our yard, the idea of property ownership, not what we're exploring this morning, but what a strange idea that we might own a piece of the earth. Of course not. And yet we have these systems that we use to think about our spaces that include ideas like land ownership, our yard. And it's important to not just take them for granted. It's important to actually think them and rethink them, so that we stay aware of the fact that these things are not to be taken for granted, that they need continuous exploration and consideration if we're going to be well in the way that we interact with them. It's good. It is good to be back. It really is. And we had a great time together as a family these past few weeks. You might kind of think, you know, because most of our kids are living at home at the moment, either because of age and stage or in some cases because of the pandemic, that, you know, having some more time together might not feel all that special. But the change in rhythm from working and living together to vacationing and living together really felt significant to me and felt much needed. So I want to say thank you to the community for that as well. Just so grateful to be part of a community that both understands the importance and the value of that, and also that has such a wonderful collection of thoughtful people to lead our Sunday explorations. Tim Penner and Arielle and Judy and Sarah, thank you. My goodness, like such thoughtful and insightful and vulnerable and courageous explorations. Thank you. Just so delightful. I felt like there was so much about those offerings that just kind of cut through the clutter of all the information overload that we deal with every day and got at really significant reflections. So thank you. Tim and Jane and Atticus and Rosie, your music. I mean, I've talked already about how delightful that whole experience was for me. Oh, just so great. It reminded me, among other things, of the happy chaos of us all being together in the same space. If we were in a shared space today, and that day will come, we will gather again. But if we were together this morning, I feel like what I would most like to do is look around the room and just look people in the eye and say, how are you doing? How are you doing? We haven't been here before. That it just keeps on coming, doesn't it? I mean, Thursday's announcement about back to school. I don't know about you, but read through that thing and felt like, oh my word, this is going to be interesting to watch our attempts to implement and measure and reconsider and all of that. Just the new just keeps on coming, and that can take quite a toll on us as human beings. It really can. I remember the first time I read the now well-known Douglas Adams Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series. This was back in college. The series wasn't even complete at that point. But I remember reading it for the first time. And I remember how it felt to sort of eventually discover in that series, in a zany fictional way, of course, but to eventually discover in that series that all the things that we think of as normal are actually us as humans functioning as the lab animals in a giant social experiment being conducted on us by mice, according to Douglas Adams. Sort of this cosmic reversal of how we tend to view the order of things. And for me, the parallel and the sort of illustrative part of this is the giant social experiment part. Because it seems to me like even if we've arguably brought this circumstance of a global pandemic on ourselves, or at the very least we've created the conditions that have made it possible, the process of responding to it is full of experimenting. It's full of trying to find the best way forward. And when that kind of process happens in some faraway lab, you know, like when people are experimenting with something new in a theoretical or experimental way, or when it happens in sort of the heady realms of things like philosophy or, you know, theoretical physics or something, we may be able to look at something like that with a little bit more of a sense of interested detachment. But when it happens in the midst of our everyday lives, when it happens in ways that mess with our relationships and with our work and with our kids' education and with our health and our safety, and that shake up our systems of belief about the world and how it functions, and when it happens in those kind of realms, detachment just flies out the window. And sometimes we just find ourselves up to our ears in both circumstances and feelings that are overwhelming. And that's not an easy place to live. All of that can also be made more complex by something that is sometimes also helpful, which is the ease with which we can access information. And I am, personally, I'm grateful to be able to fire up my browser and find information in moments. I do find that I need to constantly remind myself that a lot of the information that is available to me is not on offer from neutral parties, or to put it into a phrase it more positively, a lot of the information that's available to me readily is on offer from parties that are not neutral. And I'm not about to launch into some kind of a, you know, rant about fake news or conspiracy theories or anything like that. I think the most obvious version of that problem is that the majority of the news sources that are provided to us online are provided by businesses. At the bottom, you know, if you auger down in there a little ways, they might not look that way or feel that way, but in the end, that's what's going on in most of those instances. Those things are provided by services, and businesses are, they exist to be profitable, to make money. And that means they need to figure out what sells, and they need to provide that. Now, in the news business, the stories that sell best are the stories that provoke a reaction. And that's just all sort of terribly obvious. What might be a little less obvious, unless we reflect on it, is what sorts of things tend to produce a reaction in us. And one of our most reactive and powerful emotions is fear. And so the headlines tend to be dominated by fear-inducing themes or by information that's presented in ways that stir up those deep emotional responses in us, because that's what keeps us coming back and clicking. That's what sells. It's pretty simple. I think half the battle is just being aware of those kind of things so that we can view the world we're in from a more informed perspective. And it's intriguing how many different things work like this. I was tempted when I was writing this part of the reflection this morning and the exploration to kind of dive into the way religion functions like this. I'm not going to, because this would be distracting and it's sort of not where we're at topically, but to neglect the idea that religion is also a business is to be very naive about the nature of the way religion functions in culture. So there's lots of things that work like this. And I was struck by this at one moment on our vacation this past week. One of the things we did a bit more than usual while on vacation was, than we usually do, was spend some of the late evening hours watching movies together. And Kale was able to be with us for some of that vacation time. And Kale tends to be our go-to person for movie selection, because lots of reasons, I suppose. But some of them are that he's thoughtful about his film selection. He's informed, spends time actually researching this, and he's actually done some formal film studies. So his education about film is wider and deeper than any of the rest of us. And so when we watch films with Kale, we don't tend to just watch the movie and then call it a day. We have conversations about them, which is pretty great. In one of our post-movie chats this past week, Kale made an observation that really struck me. He said he wasn't aware until fairly recently of how filmmakers often use what I'm going to call an other filter, in quotes. And they use that when they want us to imagine we're in some other country or culture other than the one the film originates from, or when they want us to feel a certain way about what we're looking at. The film we were watching included a plot line about a person of Asian descent who had come to the U.S., but they hadn't been allowed to bring their son with them because of some dissenting perspective that she had written as a journalist while living in her home country of China. Long story short, when we finally get to see her son and her mother attempting to leave China, all the scenes that are supposed to be in China are this kind of grimly gray blue color. They have this cast to them. And they depict a cold, inhospitable sort of place, the kind of place that you really couldn't wait to get away from. If it had been Mexico or South America or even Africa, the tint would more likely have had a reddish hue. The sensation would have been of being somewhere too hot rather than too cold. But the land, the sky, the cityscapes, even the people would have looked different from the good place that they were trying to get to. And I'd never really noticed that before as a technique in filmmaking. But once Kale pointed out, I could think of sort of myriad instances of its occurrence. It's a way of othering. It's a way of othering characters and locations and cultures without advertising that it's being done. It's not hidden. It's in full view. We're looking right at it. But we need to do the work of learning about it and paying attention to it if we want to avoid heedlessly taking in a perspective that we might not affirm or agree with, or even just that we wish to question for ourselves. And it's not just about avoiding heedlessly doing that. It's not just about avoiding something. It's also about being able to see the same circumstances, taking the same information with different eyes, to see it through a different lens or from a different point of view. And that sometimes requires standing back. That sometimes requires reflecting on what's in front of us in a more questioning way, a way that asks, what shall I make of, or how might I think about what is right in front of me? Never mind what's hidden, just the stuff that's right there. And that's the case for things like movies, for things like, excuse me, as we've already talked about, for things like the news, and also for this huge range of our human experiences, right? The things that are right in front of us, the things that we're immersed in fact. Excuse me. It's not about trying to make the filters go away. It's not about trying to make the filters go away, whether they're things like profit motive for news agencies or things like color filters for filmmakers. It's about trying to find a perspective from which we can consider those sorts of things and consciously decide how we want to think about them and live with them. It's about informing our lens or our view. For most of the wise ones in history, this process of standing back has been essential. And it's been a process of trying to take a wide sample of human experiences and then extrapolate some bigger themes, or maybe even come to some conclusions, even if those feel a bit tentative or open to further exploration, and then to apply those to what their personal experiences have been. So to sort of do this wide survey-ish kind of work, and then the filtering down work, and then to kind of go, well, if these are some of the themes that feel like they're emerging, and I take those ideas and I put them on my life experiences as a way of looking at things, what kind of comes out the other side of that process? What do I learn about how to think about the experiences that I've had and am having, and the way that they fit with life, the universe, and everything, and the way that they intersect with our great existential questions? You know, the who am I? What's the nature of the world that I'm in? What's wrong with the world that I'm in? Is there anything that can be done about that? And so on and so forth. Sort of those big 30,000 foot explorations. Now, that's the same kind of thing that we try to do with our formal realms of study, whether that's academic or sort of just personal exploration. We try to survey a wide range of material and then apply it to our experiences. And obviously, that means that we bring our biases with us. We do tend to see what we want to see or what we expect to see. This is increasingly clear that this is the case as we study that you know, our confirmation bias and so on. Even when the information that's in front of us seems to suggest otherwise, we're pretty great as a species at seeing what we expect to, and not so great at kind of getting knocked off that perspective or out of that bias so we can consider something else. That takes a lot of work. But it's better to do the work than not do it, even if we bring our own biases with us, because if we don't do it, that simply means that someone else's biases end up being the ones that we see the world through. And I'm not sure that it's a good idea to swallow the world whole from somebody else's point of view. I think this is work that is pretty important for us to do for ourselves. So, by way of at least getting started down that path, what I want to do this morning is set up a way of taking some ancient wisdom and putting it alongside some contemporary perspectives, with the general purpose being the seeking of some new ways that we might view this particular giant sort of experience / social experiment of a global pandemic and our ongoing involvement in it. So that's kind of what I want to try to offer as a way in to that process that's maybe a little different than the things we usually do. So I'm going to use a device that I've never tried at the table before. And frankly, I'm feeling a little bit nervous about this because I've got some skin in the game. This could totally tank. And if it does, I'll have no one to hold responsible but myself. One of the ways it could tank is by being utterly cheesy, like just the worst sort of cheesy, which would be embarrassing. But I've decided I want to try it anyway, not least of all because I believe that one of the essential tools for exploring what we believe is imagination, and another is risk. And this device feels like it's one way of sort of bringing those two things together. So that's kind of what's running in the background for me. So basically, what I want to try to do is make a kind of reader's theater with the camera pointed at the process. Reader's theater, for those not familiar, is essentially what radio theater was like back in the pre-screen days, but without the sound effects. Really, or sort of without the acting as well, because it really is more just people reading the script. There's a bit of inflection, there's some characterization added, but not a lot. It's not so much a dramatization as it is a reading of whatever the text is, whatever the script is. In our cultural setting, this probably would be akin to what you might see if someone puts up a YouTube video of a couple of people recording a podcast. You know, it's sort of a static camera and people sitting there and they're talking or reading or discussing whatever they're discussing. So sort of like that. So that's not going to happen this morning. That's going to happen next week, all being according to plan. And goodness knows, sometimes these plans do not come to fruition, but that's the plan. And what I want to do this morning is set all that up for us. I want to introduce us to the characters, just sort of briefly. I want to give us a little bit of background. And then next week, we'll actually do the Reader's Theater part. All right, so I'm still very much in the process of making this up. But at this point, in my imagination, there are two characters in this conversation. As I suggested in the blurb, one of them is an ancient king from what we would now think of as the Middle East, from the time period somewhere between 450 and 200 BCE. And the ancient wisdom source I'm going to draw on for the king character is the biblical book of Ecclesiastes. Now, personally, I really like Ecclesiastes. I like it because it doesn't belong. I like it because it's an outlier. From a literary point of view, it's one of the 24 books in the Hebrew scriptures where it's classified as one of the writings, which is not just like people wrote this down, so it must be called a writing. That's actually a category of Hebrew literature. And it has somehow survived the process of elimination and ended up in almost all the versions of Christian scriptures as well, despite all sorts of discussion historically about the problems that presents. This ranges from the Jewish rabbis seriously considering editing Ecclesiastes before including it in the Hebrew canon, because of the existential challenges that it presents and the questions that it doesn't answer. And the Christian debate historically about whether it should be included in the Bible or not is considerable and quite interesting, if that sort of thing intrigues you. But in any case, it did survive that process, and there it is in both the Hebrew canon and the Christian canon, in the sacred texts of both those traditions. In general, it's thought of as a wisdom book. It wrestles with existential questions. We don't know who wrote it. Traditional Jewish texts into the 18th and even 19th centuries still suggest that the author is Solomon, but most contemporary scholars would reject that for a variety of reasons that we're not going to get into. The title of the book actually tells us as much about its authorship as anything else. Little word nerd moment, because, you know, it'd be too bad if we didn't have one of those. The word Ecclesiastes is a Greek transliteration. Most of our English translations come from the Greek. A bunch of you probably knew that, but in any case, the word Ecclesiastes is a Greek transliteration of the Hebrew word that was the original title, which was Koheleth or Kohelet. I'm going to use Koheleth just because for some reason it runs easier off my tongue. And the word itself means, we're not exactly sure what the Hebrew word means, but it seems to mean something like one who speaks to the assembly or teacher. Now, if you really want to get nerdy about it, it has an intriguingly feminine tone to it, but that doesn't seem to be the essential part of the way that it's been translated. Intriguing partly because in the Hebrew tradition, wisdom is a feminine character, something we've talked about before. So in any case, the context seems to suggest that the most important meaning or most sort of weighty meaning in the setting that we find it is one who speaks to the assembly. So someone's addressing the people on about these things that they've learned. Now that name, Koheleth, that's also the pseudonym, the pen name for the author who writes as a third-person narrative. That's not the name of the author. That's the name that the author, this third-person narrator, uses for the king, whose life experiences form the content of the story. So the king's name is Koheleth. So what we end up with is something sort of like a narrated memoir, but with the emphasis more on the philosophical and existential wrestlings of Koheleth than on the details of the life lived. And so, you know, for instance, we don't have like all this. I grew up in, you know, this town and my mother was such and so, and not a lot of that. It's more about the reflection, which we might sum up in terms of Koheleth's lived experiences by saying Koheleth has seen and done it all. They got a big scope of experience to draw on from their perspective. So in any case, the book is a collection of the musings of this king of Jerusalem, his experiences, his perspectives, and what they've taught him about the meaning of life. So kind of big theme stuff. And his overall conclusion regarding the meaning of life is that the actions of humans are essentially heved, a Hebrew word that means breath or vapor, but it often gets translated as insubstantial, vain, or futile. Oh man, our son Tyrion follows a philosophy Instagram page. My kids just keep surprising me. So Tyrion's been listening to this podcast. It's like an unedited history of philosophy. Who knew? 200 and some episodes. Anyway, I think maybe that led him to follow this particular Instagram page called Casual Nihilism, which is occasionally very often actually very funny, occasionally also very dark. Anyway, he sent me a post from it the other day that this is the conversation between God and a human. God, you probably have 70 to 80 years at most before you die, ideally. Human. Oh. Well, then I'll make the most of God. You'll be unconscious for a third of the time. Human. God leans in. That'll be your favorite part. So the point being, of course, that, you know, if we live to 70 or 80 years old, we spend, 43 to 50 or something of those years awake and the rest of them asleep. And that's sort of that's where it ends. And that's where lots of folks leave the Koheleth, the Ecclesiastes conversation. Koheleth says that life is futile and meaningless, so let's leave him to wallow in his bleak perspective. And let's carry on to the good stuff. You know, the stuff that tells you how, if you believe the right things and do the right things, then life's going to turn out great for you because God is on your side and God will come through and God will make it that way. If not now, then later, you know, that stuff. And the drive toward that perspective, that that's the way the universe functions, the drive toward that perspective is so strong that the later editors of Ecclesiastes have even added it to the end of the book, which now concludes with, "Fear God and keep his commandments, for that is the whole duty of everyone." Pretty much every scholar, every contemporary biblical scholar would say that's an addendum. That wasn't put there by that original third-person narrator telling the story of Qoheleth's wisdom. It just ended without that. But now it's there. And that sort of reflects, among other things, that we just, like, we want that to be the story. There's something in us that wants that to be the story. And also, and I don't think this is cynical, I think there's lots of ways to demonstrate this, that idea, you know, fear God and keep his commandments, that's the whole duty of everyone, that's a lot more orthodox, and it fits a lot better with most religious structures than an idea like human life is vapor, so make sure you have something that you really like for dinner tonight. And if you're partnered and that partner includes sexual pleasure, then you should probably have dinner and then go have great sex, because that's, you know, that's what you get. And then tomorrow you go back to work, right? So that can seem like the place where Ecclesiastes ends up before the editorial editions. That's sort of the summary. But the book itself never goes to that conventionally orthodox place. It just doesn't. In fact, it so insistently doesn't go there that lots of scholarship has gone into musing about how it ended up being allowed to stay in a collection of writings, both the Hebrew scriptures and the Christian scriptures, that overall are often read or used as documents to answer the "what does life really mean" question in pretty clear terms, right? That's often the way those texts get approached. And here's this chunk of, whether you think of it as memoir or whether you think of it as a longer poem, which it can be read as well, here's this book that just won't do it. It just refuses to do it. So basically, while this king clearly endorses wisdom as the best way to live an earthly life, they are, in the final event, unable to ascribe any eternal meaning to it. Huh. How about that? So, like I said, in terms of Hebrew or Christian sacred texts, it's an outlier, and a remarkably contemporary outlier at that. The perspective of Qoheleth is redolent with ideas that we are also surrounded by in the 21st century. And the other reason I like this book is because Qoheleth is clearly a person of privilege. Now, that might sound like a pretty great reason to not like a piece of writing because of this bias that it represents. It's like, Qoheleth, check your privilege at the castle gate, you know? But the reason I find that helpful is because I identify with it. I have existential questions, and under the current cultural circumstances, I actually live, from almost any global perspective, I live a lot like that ancient ruler would have. I have access to relatively great wealth, to relatively significant personal power, and to a variety of pleasures, all things that this king goes searching for meaning in. Now, there are some obvious exceptions. For instance, I don't have slaves, I don't have a harem, my word is not law, so, you know, it's not apples with apples, you could say. On the other hand, if I choose to, I can buy jeans that are made by wage slaves. I don't keep a harem, but I have access to pornography, which strikes me as not entirely dissimilar idea. Plus, when a cop comes to my car window, I don't immediately feel like my life is in danger. So, while my word isn't law, my word feels, as a white person in this culture, this time at least, my word feels connected to the shape of law in a way that gives it some heft. So maybe the parallels are closer than they seem. In any case, I feel like I share some of that sense of agency to explore what is meaningful, to explore my existential questions in my life. And I also feel subject to human limitations, including limitations to that agency. But I realize that I am subject to them in a moment-by-moment way to a lesser degree than a person of less privilege would be. I feel conscious of that. And I expect that that'll show up in the musings of our Reader's Theater character somewhere. So that's the starting place for me when it comes to writing the character of Qoheleth. We'll see how I do. You get to judge. I'm going to spend a lot less time this morning outlining the psychologist character, the other character in this Reader's Theater, because they're contemporary. They're a 21st century psychologist. They're going to be a bit of a mashup of that idea, also a bit of a mashup of the purveyors of our contemporary ideas about psychology and those that are informed by them, which really is all of us. So in some ways they will be a contemporary of ours who is a specialist, who is a psychologist by training and education and practice. Psychology, of course, is in very general terms, because it's a very broad science, it's the science of mind and behavior. What we think, how our thinking, our brain works, how we behave, and what are the relationships between those things, how we think and the processes of that, and how what we do with that, how that comes out in our lives. A lot of psychologists, in terms of the way we encounter this science, end up working as mental health practitioners. They end up working in clinical or therapeutic situations. Now, not just that, of course, because there's many different branches of psychology, but probably most of us, when we think about a psychologist, we tend to think about a mental health practitioner. And so that'll be part of the vantage point of that character as well. And since we're talking about wisdom as applied to our experiences of a global health emergency or a pandemic, mental health is obviously a big factor there, as is spiritual health and physical health and relational health and social health and so on and so forth. I expect that our particular psychologist will end up with a bit of a philosophical bent as well, given that their conversation will be with Koaleth, who obviously, is inclined that way. I'm not being coy about the plot of the conversation. It's not been written yet. So I'm just inviting you right into the messy process here with me. The setting for the conversation, I expect, will be contemporary. It'll be right now, right here. We are not going to trouble ourselves with how it might be possible that a king from 300 plus years before the Christian era began is sitting and chatting with a 21st century psychologist. That's just how it's going to be. And for those of you that love science fiction and, troubleshooting all those things, you just go right ahead. But you'll be speculating, because I will not have put any significant amount of thought into it as a writer. So you can just have your way with it. I expect there will be massive continuity issues and inconsistencies. But if I do a reasonable job of the script, my hope is that it will get us thinking about how ancient existential musings and contemporary science can not only work together to inform our imaginations, our beliefs, and our lives, but also that there are some profoundly significant overlapping themes, and I use the word advisedly, even conclusions. And I think that's really important in a community that exists to explore belief. I mean, this could feel like, especially if you're somebody that just dropped into this community for the first time and listened to this, could feel like we just spent half an hour talking about everything but faith. Which is kind of intriguing to me, because it suggests, among other things, that our conversations about faith are often detached from our conversations about the rest of reality. One of the reasons that the debate has raged as vigorously as it has about whether Ecclesiastes should even be in a book like the Bible is because of the vantage point from which people have thought about those texts, predominantly as texts that answer questions. Not a perspective I share. I'm not alone in that, I'd realize, because there's other people in this community, for one thing. I think actually it's a collection of people's wrestlings with questions and raising of questions, and that it does its best work as a collection when we let it raise questions, when we let it provoke the exploration of what we believe, rather than looking to it as a collection of texts that will answer those existential questions in definitive last word sorts of ways. When we explore spirituality, when we explore faith and belief, we're exploring the realm of mystery. We have words for that mystery that give it some shape, so we can actually talk about it, we can discuss it, we can reflect on it, we can question it, we can meaningfully interact with it, so we need language for that, so we come up with language for that. Other people come up with different language for that same realm of exploration. And although these things don't, maybe historically, haven't always spoken to one another in meaningful, helpful ways, they can. And I feel like we have the privilege of living in this 21st century world at a time when that's starting to happen, when that dialogue, I think, is as vigorous maybe as it's almost ever been in history. Partly because we can have it so in such a global way. The same things that have created the conditions for a virus to travel globally with real rapidity have created the wonderful conditions for ideas and cross-pollination of ideas to travel rapidly and vigorously globally. Pretty great space in which to explore, among other things, what we believe. So that's what we're going to try to do next week, is a bit of that exploration. And the context will be the consideration of how all these things can inform the way we think about and interact with and engage and participate in, this may sound like a strange way to phrase it, but engage and participate in a global health crisis, a pandemic. I'm going to do something that I don't usually do just because of environment. I don't know if you can hear the siren in the background. We've done this on one or two other occasions, and I'm going to close this way. Because it's sort of what has come to me. That siren is going somewhere particular in the midst of all these big musings, these grand questions. They usually signify disruption in someone's life that is acute and particular and difficult. And so we didn't take the time to breathe together this morning. I'm going to invite us to end our time this morning by taking some time to breathe. And while we breathe, may I suggest that we have in mind what that brings to mind, that sound, that ambulance siren brings to mind. And that may bring to mind the larger themes that we're wrestling with in terms of global health, physical health, mental health, social health. It may bring to mind some particular personal experience, I don't know. If it brings to mind something too distressing, and I'm not saying this is never an obligatory exercise, just step away. But I would invite you to that possibility. I'm going to go through three rounds of square breathing, in for a count of three, cradle my breath for a count of three, out for a count of six. And if you wish, and you think about this kind of time as prayer, then you could also spend this time praying for whoever's part of that story or whatever story comes to mind when we pause. And then we'll gather again next week, and we'll see where our explorations, led by Coaleth and a yet-to-be-named fictional psychologist, take us in terms of exploring what we believe. So let's wrap up by breathing together. It's been good to be with you all, even if it had to be this way, and I look forward to being together next week. All right, let's breathe. Peace, everyone. Bye for now.